Okay, folks, you are listening to Life on Planet Porky. And the first thing I suppose I've got to do is wish you all a Happy New Year. Biting my fingers, I do that. Anyway, look, I'm the Porkmeister, delighted to say in the studio with me today, the return of Leslie Ann Jones. Leslie Ann, lovely to see you, my dear.
Yes, I'm back, and Happy New Year. I knew you hate saying that after the actual day itself.
But... Well, I think it's so crass. You know, look, you know, once midday on New Year's Day's come up, don't say Happy New Year to anybody after that, because, frankly, we've got to get on with a new world, you know, a new year, a new life, new challenges and all that. And anybody who's, you know, floating around for 5 or 6 days after New Year's Eve, oh, it's New Year, Happy New Year, is not concentrating on their life plan.
I take your point, but let me ask you something.
Yes.
Are we in a new decade?
No. The new decade doesn't start till the end of this year.
That's what I think. But there's a raging debate on the internet.
Of course there is, yeah. But you get any newspaper editor to defy the odds and actually do it properly, the new decade starts on midnight of 2020 going out of the year. You see what I mean?
Exactly that.
Into
I'm 21. With you.
But because everybody's jumped on the bandwagon, the new decade is 2020, they're completely wrong.
Do you remember New Year's Eve 1999?
Yes, I do. With the
and
millennium.
That whole thing
yeah.
about the new yeah. millennium and all yeah. that. It was completely wrong.
Yes.
Everybody celebrated it.
Yes, that's right.
The money that was spent on parties.
Yeah.
And of course, it wasn't actually the new millennium
until
the end of the following year.
It wasn't. It was a huge embarrassment to Tony Blair's new government as well, because the O2, which was opened that night, was a complete not a failure, because the queues took people 2 hours to get in. You know, none of the approach lines were right, none of the transport was right, the exits and entrances and
it's
all
still
that.
Like that, by the way.
Well, yeah, but it's now very highly profitable. It's now been turned into a world-class venue, whereas it used to have ridiculous modern art sculptures in it, you know, the beating heart and all this load of bollocks.
But you don't want to go there for a gig, because you'll never get home, not till 2,
no,
3 in the
right,
morning.
No, that's right, I agree. It's on the edge of London, isn't it?
Yeah.
On the, sort of just on the edge of the East End, so to speak, New London, Canary Wharf and all that. I went there once just to have a look at it, see how bad it was, and I nearly got vertigo from watching a load of trapeze artists, right, who were literally flying around in the roof of the O2, which is massively high, without any safety nets.
Oh, yeah, they do all that.
It honestly gave me vertigo. I thought, my God, I've got to get out of it.
Did you have vertigo home?
Sorry. Yeah, quite
the
right.
best gig experience I ever had there
yes.
was a Fleetwood Mac gig.
Oh, yeah.
A few years ago now.
This is at the O2?
Yeah. And got on the boat up near Waterloo and sailed down the Thames.
Yes.
Champagne on the boat.
Yes.
Got off.
When you say sailed, there were no sails on this boat. It's like one of those clippers.
All right, floated.
Yes,
you know,
yes.
whatever. Had a glass of champagne. In fact, a couple. Got there, had a great gig.
Yeah.
The gig went late because Fleetwood Mac do play long.
Yeah.
But the boat waited. And even though it was pitch black, you know, we had this nice sail or float back into London.
Yes.
And then picked up our cars and went home.
What, you got into a car after drinking champagne all night?
Only a couple.
God.
Not all night. You do exaggerate. He does exaggerate.
Probably had a driver anyway. I'm very nervous about going on those boats on the Thames now, because I was the news editor who covered that dreadful crash on the river. Remember? Lawrence Dallaglio's sister died in it.
Oh,
What was it? I forget what it was called.
Was it the same one, Jonathan Pang? It was Jonathan Pang's birthday party, wasn't it?
Well, was it?
Yeah.
I mean, this huge dredger, which had aggregates in it, that's like, you know, stones that they scoop up from the base of the River Thames, from the riverbed, and weighing thousands of tons, came bundling down the river late at night.
The Marchioness.
The Marchioness was the boat where the party was taking place. A tiny, by comparison, tiny vessel made of matchwood by comparison, on which there were like 90 young people, and the dredger sliced through it, cut it in two, smashed it to pieces, and a load of people died. It was terribly tragic.
And Jonathan, who I knew quite well a few years ago, he suffered dreadful survivor's guilt from
I'm sure he would,
because it was his party and he lost half his friends.
Yeah, well, and as I say, Lawrence Dallaglio lost his sister tragically, and his mother and himself then, and still do in Lawrence's case, set up this, you know, this charity to help people who lose loved ones. You know, we're absolutely right. Now then, look, one thing I can say about sort of Christmas, New Year, although not looking back, is some great programmes started, which are still going on. Have you seen Dracula?
I hate horror. I will never watch something like that.
So do I. I hate horror, and I'm not going to watch this. But
just reading about it made me feel sick.
Yeah, well, but then...
Who needs to watch that?
Well, but then you say to yourself, I tell you what, I'll just watch the first few minutes. And it's so brilliantly done. And it started, you know, with the Transylvanian castle and all this kind of stuff. And actually, it's finished now, but it was fabulous. And the only version of Dracula I've ever liked. Years ago, I watched what was called The Pure Dracula, Bram Stoker's Dracula, you know, as the book, as he wrote the book. He wrote the book in Whitby in Yorkshire, you know. And that was crap because he started turning from a man into gas and then gas into a vampire. This one's just finished. It's great. But the story I really want to talk to you about, because it involves so much of what we did for most of our lives, right, is Christine Keeler. Have you been watching Christine
Keeler?
Well,
I caught one episode because I knew you'd want to talk about this.
Luckily, they had two to start between Christmas and New Year. Now it's every Friday.
So I caught the second one.
Yeah, yeah.
And what struck me about it, this is the first time that the story has been told from her point of view, with sympathy towards her as a young woman for the way she was exploited and abused.
Yeah.
And so I'm all for it.
Yeah. Do you think she was exploited and abused?
Yeah, definitely. She was a teenager, wasn't she?
Yeah, but she went to London looking for a bit of fun and a good time. And she had fun and a good time and started shagging politicians and anybody else.
Not necessarily looking to shag politicians, I would say.
Well,
I mean, she
ended up doing that.
She did, but she was taken by Stephen Ward and turned into his little baby, wasn't she?
Yeah,
and
he met her at a Soho strip club.
Yeah.
Well, it was like the modern equivalent of a lap dancing club, you know, girls dancing on stage and all that kind of stuff, you know. She's a very beautiful girl, so it didn't surprise me at all that she got swept into the High Russian Society. But old Profumo, what a louse, you know what I mean?
And they were pillars of society, weren't they? They were set up as, you know, fine-standing members of the establishment who could use and abuse anybody the way they wished.
Yeah, that's right.
And considered that they weren't doing wrong.
No, that's right.
That scene where he lied to his wife right into her face, you know, a couple of inches away from
but
his
she
nose.
Wasn't she wasn't pure as driven snow. They had a very open marriage. His wife was a woman called Valerie Hobson, who was an actress.
She was an actress,
she was shagging around, you know, on the Hollywood scene at the same time as Profumo was banging away at, you know, any showgirl he could get his hands on. He was a prolific shagger for Profumo. And the thing that's never really mentioned is that, you know, although Christine Keeler was the centre of this story, he had dozens of young showgirls that he was banging away in his office in Whitehall. I mean, disgrace.
And they got away with it in those days because we, as the press, I mean, we were too young to have covered that story, obviously, but we, as the press, only got so close.
Yes.
As with the royal family.
That's right.
So, you know, it was a closed shop and
I totally
different
agree.
Rules applied.
Yeah, I totally
and
agree.
Nowadays, that everything is open and everything is accessible, nobody gets away with anything anymore, least of all politicians.
That's right. I totally agree.
Now, people always bang on about the French, you know, French presidents having
that's
affairs.
Right. Mistresses and
the
all
French
that.
Don't care, you know, sexes kind of thing. Yeah. Well, actually, it matters to me because I feel that if he, as the president, cannot be honest with the closest person to him in his life, his wife, how can he be trusted to run a country?
Well, you say that, but look at our present Prime Minister, Boris Johnson. We all know that he's a philandering, avoider
Shagger.
Of the truth.
Yeah. Not a great dad, you'd have to say.
Yeah, has been sacked from jobs in the past for not sticking to accurate facts as a journalist, all sorts
left
of things.
Left his
like
wife
that.
While she was going through cancer treatment.
Left his wife going through cancer treatment, all that kind of stuff.
Would and you want to be his girlfriend? No.
At the end of the day, people don't seem to care. They almost think that he's a bit of a rascal, you know what I mean? Mm. But anyway, getting back to Keeler, right, what was great about it is that a Daily Mirror reporter, where it all started was Christine Keeler used to like mixing in the African community in Notting Hill, okay? And she liked boyfriends who were big and muscular, of coloured origin.
There was a
right?
phrase, wasn't there, which is completely on PC, which we're not supposed to say, but we can. Once you've had black, you never look back.
Oh, well, maybe that's the case. I wouldn't know, because, of course,
me
I'm a different
neither.
Sex to you. So, but anyway, thank you very much
I'm
indeed.
A different sex to me, but, you know.
Thank you very much indeed, Leslie Ann, for,
welcome.
You know, availing us of that piece of, what can I say, biophysical information.
I'm not racist, by the way.
No, of course you're not. I know you're not. But so anyway, so what happens is a grief-stricken boyfriend who's found out that Christine Keeler's been nobbing old Profumo knows that she's staying with the in-between. The in-between is a guy called Stephen, what's his name?
Ward.
Thank you, yeah. Who was, like, allegedly, you know, sort of osteopath to the rich and the famous. Mm. In fact, he was a pimp, and he used to fix up, you know, women for cabinet ministers, and used to fix deals between businessmen, all this kind of stuff. Just a high society sort of fixer, you know. But one of the aggrieved boyfriends from Notting Hill goes round and has acquired a gun and shoots bullets through the door and all this kind of stuff, you know. So she wasn't even a part of the story. It was all about Stephen Ward. And then a Daily Mirror photographer turns up, does a bit more digging than the others, like you and I would have done, you know what I mean? And suddenly finds this very beautiful girl in the middle of it, you know, starts following her a bit, tracks her down, has a cup of coffee, gives her a card. She gets a call from him. He's promised her money. She goes into the Daily Mirror and spills the beans.
And not only that, but yeah, then they went digging into her own private life, yes, as we would.
Yes.
And found that terribly sad story about her trying to cause her own abortion.
That's right.
And the child was born, yeah, and lived for 6 days, yes, in the hospital.
Yes.
That, to me, that wrenched my heart. It was so sad.
It was all heartbreaking. I totally agree. But then the one thing the Mirror got, which of course was gold dust for them, they got a handwritten letter from Profumo to Christine Keeler.
Oh, on headed note paper. Could you believe that?
Calling her darling, you know, so yeah, they had it banged up. However, I haven't got round to finding out yet how the Daily Express moved in on the story, because the Daily Express did. Before it got into print, the Daily Express got involved, and that was a Daily Express reporter involved, but that's as far as the programme's gone so far. But in those days, you see, Leslie, and as you will know, but I'm a little bit older than you, the Mirror was the giant of the left-wing press, selling about 4.4 million a day, right? Can you imagine that?
Oh, they were huge. My father was working for them at the time.
That's right. And it's down
as
now
the
to,
voice of sport.
It's down now to way under a million. Oh, I mean, yeah, probably 500,000, 600,000.
But all the circulations have come down because all the advertising is collapsed.
I was about to say, the Daily Express was the giant, I mean, absolute giant of the right, run by Lord Beaverbrook, Canadian press baron, okay, and war minister during the war, would have known Profumo very well, right, because Profumo became war minister. And they were selling 4.4 million. And they both apparently, according to old colleagues I used to work with, Barry Devney, who was an industrial reporter, they both had their 4 million circulation parties on the same night, both in Fleet Street, because they, of course, were both in Fleet Street then, or very near to Fleet Street. The Express was on Fleet Street, and the Mirror was on Holborn. But the point of the story is that's how powerful newspapers were in those days. Daily Express circulation, by the way, is down so low now, I think it's dropped below its sister paper, the Daily Star. I think it's about 285,000 or something.
They're on their way out, aren't they? We've said this for a while.
They've got to be.
The internet killed our industry.
It did.
You'd have to say.
But one of the insinuations in this story, which is great, is that somebody at the Mirror who became disenchanted, and this always happens, passed on the story to his mate on the Express, OK? Now, I'll give you a great example of where this happened in your life before. Do you remember a guy called Norman Luck?
Yeah, we've talked about him before.
Yeah, well, I think we have. Norman was a great guy. He was a great reporter. I was the news editor. Norman was, you know, one of my most trusted reporters. Died tragically when he stepped into a pothole near his house, broke his leg. The brake got septic when he was in hospital, and he died. It was terribly tragic. You know, he's a great guy, Norm. But anyway, Norman comes in one Monday morning and says, "I've got a story I can't believe." I said, "What is it?" He said, "Well, I got a call last night from..." And he named the name of the Sunday Mirror reporter, OK? And he said he's distraught. He had the story of the decade and the paper bottled it on Saturday night and wouldn't publish it. And I said, "What is it, Norm?" He said, "Somebody's broken into Buckingham Palace and ended up sitting on the Queen's bed." I said, "Oh, come off it. I couldn't possibly. How you break into..." Anyway, that was the famous story.
Climbed in through a window. Michael somebody, wasn't it?
Yeah, Michael. So, yeah, yeah. He sat
and she sat and chatted to him.
Sat and chatted to him. Anyway, of course.
Now, did she press the bell? But what we were treated to was the exposure of the fact that the Queen and the Duke of Edinburgh didn't sleep together.
Well, on that particular night, they made up a story to say that, you know, the Duke had a headache or something like that.
Wouldn't they?
Well, of course.
As Mandy Rice Davis famously said.
In her court case, yeah. But anyway, it didn't take much checking out because so much research had been done already. But the Sunday Mirror bottled it.
Now, why did they? Do we know?
Well, I've no idea. I mean, maybe they were got at by the establishment. That's the most likely scenario because they must have checked the facts out so much and realised they got it. Anyway, Norm came in. We used it Monday for Tuesday, and it went around the world for obvious reasons, you know. But that's how bitter the Sunday Mirror reporter who found the story.
He gave the story away to somebody else. There was
away.
A lot of that, though, wasn't there?
Yeah, there was.
I can remember trading stories.
Yeah.
And it was a sackable offence, of course.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
If you gave an exclusive to another paper.
Yes.
But we traded stories in those days.
I had one guy, and I'll tell you who it was Kim Sengupta. Right?
Oh, yeah, I remember him.
And Kim's still working in some form in the media. Kim was very good, and I think he's gone into like one of these, you know, media company type things, you know. But I found Kim Koo Stark, right? I found her with a photographer. We trailed around for 2 weeks every night around London's West End and Kensington and addresses in Notting Hill, and I eventually got a picture of. I think I've told you the story before. You know, her face came through a black visor with the flash of the.
Oh, you did.
But anyway, the point is. I then became a marked man for the rest of Fleet Street. They all knew that I'd found Kim Stark. There were other things to be found out. Now, I'd only just moved to London, and they put me in a basement apartment somewhere in, like, you know, Finsbury Park or something, and it was damp. It was horrible. It was a horrible place to go back to. And I said, I'm not having this anymore. And a mate of mine, who I'd been to the University of the Trent with, who was a surveyor and worked for British Rail... had moved to a lovely little village called Melbourne, halfway up the A10 towards Cambridge, you know what I mean? Because he could get free train travel into town, so he could live in Hertfordshire, you see, or Cambridgeshire, somewhere like that, you know. So, you won't believe this, but I moved out of my Finsbury Park flat, put a load of stuff in the boot, drove off, not knowing I was being followed by the Daily Mail. who thought I was going to meet Koo Stark, honestly.
Brilliant.
It was unbelievable. So we got as far as, you know, sort of halfway up the A10, and I stopped at a pub, you know, that I knew, that I'd have a drink. Anyway, I spotted them in the car park coming out, said, you know, what are you doing here? And, oh, you know, that's very coincidental and all that. And then, you know, Kim actually said, look, you know, I've got to follow you until you find Koo Stark. I can't go back to the office until then. And much to my absolute shame, I led him on terribly. We went to another couple of pubs, right?
You took him on a goose chase.
I took him on a wild
goose
chase.
Man.
And I said, she's going to be in here, you know, and I'll share this with you because I've already got the scoop and, you know, Kim, you're an old friend. And every time we went somewhere, I pretended that, you know, oh, she's going to be here. And I pretended that there were no mobile phones in those days, that the waiter was giving me a message and I'd come back to the table and say, she's going to be here in 15. Kim would then disappear to the payphone in the corridor and ring his news desk and say, she'll be here in 15, get the photographers over here and all that kind of stuff. Honestly. And he hated me for a while afterwards, Kim, because I had made a complete fool of him.
Not surprised.
And it wasn't nice. But it was nothing to do with Koo Stark. The Koo Stark story was over, you know what I mean?
It's like a Lord Lucan story, you know.
Yeah.
The best career in Fleet Street was spending years not finding Lord Lucan.
Absolutely. And some people made an absolute career of it. OK, folks, you are listening to Life on Planet Porky with myself and the very wonderful Leslie Ann Jones. We've been talking about Christmas TV, New Year's TV. Don't want to keep harping on about Christmas and New Year, but we haven't been with you since all that happened. I noticed in a publication today, Leslie Ann, right, that the TV figures for 1973 were published on this day, 1973, top of the list, Morecambe and Wise, 28 million. Second on the list, Bruce Forsyth, 24 million. And third on the list, 23 million, another show. But, I mean, this year, they're celebrating...
Gavin and Stacey, 17 point something million.
Oh, was it as high as that?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Oh, was it? Oh, that's very good. Because considering there's so many hundreds of stations now... And
also, the figures are way down on terrestrial television because we've got Netflix and everything else.
Yes.
So there's no comparison to be made, really.
Oh, no figures at all. I also noticed, by the way... Oh, that was 1976, by the way, the year. I've just checked that. I also noticed that on this day that we're doing this recording, right, a man was born who, for me, was great, one of the greatest TV actors ever, and that was John Thorpe. John Thorpe, Manchester-born actor, starred in Inspector Morse and Kavanagh after The Sweeney. Abandoned by his mother at seven, he and his younger brother were left in the care of his lorry driver father and the lady upstairs, who was his father's mistress. He became a market porter in London, but then used that to fund himself to go to RADA and, of course, became a legend. I mean, to me, John Thorpe was the ultimate TV cop.
Well, he was, but he wasn't a great actor, was he?
I thought he was.
No, he played himself in every single thing.
I thought as Inspector Jack, Jack Reagan. I thought Inspector Jack Reagan, he took on all the mannerisms of a policeman. He mixed with policemen. He tried to talk like, I thought he was brilliant.
But that was his personality. In Moors, he was the same guy.
Yeah.
Much as Dennis Waterman always plays himself.
Yes.
You could say Rock Hudson, you could say Sean Connery.
Yeah.
You know, Sean Connery, even as a Russian agent, played it with a Scottish accent.
Yeah.
There wasn't a whole lot of acting went on there, but I think it was the personality of John Thorpe that we really fell for.
I thought he was brilliant, and I thought he was hopeless in everything else. I thought he was hopeless in Kavanagh QC because he tried to adopt this northern, rough, tough northern barrister, man of the people, and all this kind of stuff, which I didn't think came off.
He was George Carman in that, though, wasn't he? I think he modelled himself on George Carman.
I think you're right. I did a case with George Carman once.
Talk to me about George Carman.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah, absolutely demolished me and the doc.
Hang on, let's let the audience know who George Carman is. George Carman was one of the most famous barristers in the history of our career in Fleet Street. Made his name by getting Jeremy Thorpe off the attempted murder charge and forever became very famous. So when did you bump into him?
So I was working for You magazine, the Mail on Sunday colour supplement, which was not lipstick and tights in those days, as it tends to be today. And I'd written an interview with Jason Connery, son of Sean,
who played Sherwood Forest Robin
Hood. Robin
Hood,
that was it.
Yeah.
And he was about to go on stage in a Wilbur Smith theatre adaptation of one of his novels.
Yeah, great, yeah.
And
is that a cowboy novel?
I can't remember.
Yeah, anyway,
it's so long ago, early 90s. And came out with the memorable phrase, which kind of sank into the piece in a magazine, as it would, saying, I'd rather die than fight for my country.
Yeah.
So this piece came out and nobody remarked on it.
Did he say that in the text of the play or did he say it in an interview?
In relation to him not being a warmonger, pacifist.
I see.
It was that kind of approach.
Okay.
And the quote just sank into the piece.
Yes.
Only a couple of days later, a reporter on The Sun picked it up and made a headline out of it.
So You is published once a week. So,
it came out
the following Sunday.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then a couple of days after it was published, The Sun picked up on it and they ran a massive headline, Son of 007 wouldn't fight for his country.
Yeah, great story.
And Jason Connery sued The Sun.
Right.
I was called as a witness. I said I didn't want to be called as a witness because I hadn't written the piece for The Sun.
Yes.
I'd written it for You magazine.
Yes.
But I was called.
Right.
And Carman demolished me. He'd gone into my private life, pulled out a variety of things, which he then exaggerated, as was his wont, and took me to pieces in the witness box. Private Eye wrote about it.
Golly.
Years later, my youngest daughter was at a school in Dulwich, and a man approached me outside of the school. He said, "You Leslie Ann Jones?" I said, "Yeah."
Yeah.
He said, "My name is Dominic Carman. My father was George Carman.
Yeah.
And I want to apologise to you for what my father did to you. It was appalling." I went to a dinner party that week and there was a book by Dominic Carman being discussed at this dinner party.
Yeah.
Somebody had a copy.
What did Dominic Carman do then?
Well, I can't remember. No. But he'd had a terrible life with this dreadful person of a father who also was a curb crawler, who also had a penchant for rent boys, who was known...
Women.
Well, both. He was known around the clubs of Manchester for picking up underage people,
I was going to tell you my Carman experience. I did this incredible trial when I was a very young reporter on The Express working in Manchester. I only did a year there at the start of my career and then moved to Fleet Street. But this fantastic trial, and I may have told you about it before. Certainly I've told the wider audience about it, but this is where Carman comes in. There was a guy called Dr. Paul Vickers, who was head of the ethics committee on the BMA, but he was based in County Durham, okay? And his wife was ill. I mean, she'd been ill for years. And she had things like, what's that stuff when all your white blood cells go? Anemia. You know, she had anemia. She was just unwell, nobody quite knew why. And he was a doctor, he couldn't find out why. But he then employed a new assistant called Pamela somebody, And I always got it confused with Pamela Bordes, who was the
Pamela with two L's.
Pamela, yeah. You know, of Andrew
everybody's Neil best friend.
Everybody's best
we
friend.
We all saw
yeah.
her knickers.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah, no, it's absolutely true. But so this lady Pamela, and she was a really vivacious blonde, and this middle-aged doctor completely fell for her, you know. And the allegation was that, and she was cleared, by the way. They were both charged with murder, right, at Leeds Crown, Teesside Crown Court. And it was a fantastic story. He was about 47, she was about 25, 26. The allegation that the prosecution put forward was that she had enticed him to overdose his wife because he was a doctor, he could. And his wife died, and then she was going to marry him, and, you know, we're going to be happily ever after. But she did herself in by admitting to the police during the investigation of the wife's death that she'd actually been sent to the chemist by the doctor to cash prescriptions in to get the tablets to go back. It was an amazing case.
Silly,
absolutely
yeah.
amazing. Anyway.
People hang themselves, don't they? Given enough rope.
Anyway, George Carman was prosecuting, okay, on behalf of the Crown, obviously. And, everybody assumed that it must be a contract, but it was very close indeed. Vickers was an outstandingly bright man who gave Carman a run for his money, you know, and all this kind of stuff.
Clever guy, George Carman.
Yeah.
But an evil bastard, you'd have to say.
Yeah, well, she got off. Pamela Bordes got off. The jury just said, young girl, not
that. Or the other Pamela,
yeah.
You mean?
But the point of my story is, as usual in one of these things, in a place like Teesside, all the press stayed in the same hotel. And it was called the Dragonora Hotel in Leeds. I don't know why we stayed in Leeds. I don't think there's anywhere decent in Middlesbrough. I think that must be the case, you know. No, that's wrong. That's wrong. It wasn't the Dragonora. I know what it was. It was a country house hotel in County Durham. I remember this very well now. So we're all staying in the same, and we're all swapping notes. The only person who could actually transcribe everything was the PA reporter, because they were brilliant at shorthand and we weren't. So most of us didn't pay any attention during the day. We just got all the PA notes at night, you know. But the point of the story is that George Carman would turn up at 6 o'clock every night at the hotel, and we would wine and dine him all night, sometimes till midnight or 1 o'clock in the morning, right? And he would tell the most fantastic stories about the legal world. He was so indiscreet about the people in the dock and what he knew about them. The judge, he told us things about the judge, you know, he was a terrible man. He was a total drunk, honestly, trying it on with all the female reporters. You know, I mean, it's a sort of... He's dead now, isn't he?
Oh, he is.
Yeah, thank God for that.
Yeah, thank God for that.
Yeah,
but he was
yeah.
vicious. He was a nasty
yeah.
bastard. And
yeah.
I still wince. You know, this is donkey's years ago,
yes.
but I still wince when I think about it,
yeah.
what he did to me.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I don't blame you. You know, he was clearly a very clever man. But all genii are flawed, aren't they? Now, I tell you what I want to talk to you about, because it's still going on, and increasingly over the last week or two, Leslie, and I've been getting more and more angst about it, is these fires in Australia.
Oh, don't.
I mean,
are they ever going to end? Can you watch it?
Are they ever going to end? And I want to know why somebody in this country, and I may have to assume this role myself, has not got a volunteer band of firefighters together to get on an aeroplane, fly to Australia and offer our services to the Australian nation to help fight their fires.
To do what?
To help fight
without
their fires.
Without any equipment? Without any protective clothing or anything?
Well, we can hold a hose, which is an expression which the idiotic Australian Prime Minister used when he was asked to come back home. Can you imagine, he was on fucking holiday in Hawaii.
Did you see the way they tore him to shreds yesterday?
Quite
right, too.
People refusing to shake hands with him.
Firefighters refusing.
Firefighters saying, you know, where have you been? You're a disgrace and all this kind of stuff. He's actually on holiday in Hawaii with his family and actually used the expression in a TV interview, what good is me coming back to Australia? I don't hold a hose. No, you're the leader of the country, you half-bake, you know. So I'm thinking... Excuse me, because there's very close ties between us and Australia. I'm thinking if somebody... I might start this. From this very moment, I might start this, OK? I might decide to start an organisation on a website or something asking for 250 volunteers. We'll get an aeroplane. Somebody will provide the money for an aeroplane. You know, somebody like some billionaire or something.
Some Richard Branson.
Yes, a Richard Branson or, you know, a billionaire from Australia or something like that. And we will fly there. And we will become, like, adopted firemen. We'll go into the bush and try and put these fires out, OK? I think we should. I'm amazed nobody's done it yet. You know, international cooperation is something we should do. We've got a massive overseas aid budget of 17 billion quid, which goes to countries which are developing and getting wealthier, and yet we're subsidising their economies, like India
who
and
have
China.
A space programme.
Yeah.
And we're still dishing out dosh.
Absolutely.
But that's got to stop, by the way.
That has got to stop. We can get on to that another time. But that has definitely got to stop. On that, by the way, again, you know, you watch a lot of telly over the festive period and all that kind of. I hate these adverts that tell me that children walk 10 miles to get clean water. I hate these adverts that go on, which we've talked about sight saves and all kind of stuff. I hate these adverts which show me donkeys being treated disgracefully in foreign climes. If we've got an overseas aid budget, shouldn't it be doing that? Shouldn't it be providing clean water for children
of course,
that African country?
And those
instead
ads.
Of some, instead of some charity putting an advert on TV, and you know that the people who run that charity are getting paid hundreds of thousands of pounds to peddle that misery.
Of course. And not only that, but the ads are not free. They're costing a fortune.
That's what I mean.
So it's big business for them. It's appalling.
Yeah.
But the Australia crisis came to a head for me the other night. I went on New Year's Day night to see Little Women with my daughter.
Oh, where was that?
Just down in the picture house in Dulwich.
Yeah.
And before the picture began,
yes,
up comes this spoof ad. It looked like a spoof ad to me, starring Kylie Minogue.
Yeah.
All the reasons why we Brits should visit Australia. And I'm thinking, love, your country's on fire.
Yeah, exactly.
What is this?
Yeah.
Whoever sanctioned that to
How
go
mad.
Out at this particular time?
How mad. Utterly mad.
But what about the koala bears?
Well, the koala bears are going to be extinct, right? Now, I've spoken to an expert on this. Koala bears will be extinct after these fires.
They can't stand the smoke inhalation, can they?
Well, it's not just that. Do you know a koala bear sleeps 20 hours a day and then eats eucalyptus
Eucalyptus is all gone.
Well, it's not just that. What I didn't realise, because I've started doing some investigations how I can help, is that a koala bear, they're called koalas, but everybody calls them koala bears, you know. The koalas can only survive on eucalyptus in their region. So, for instance, if you take all the koalas which have survived in New South Wales and say, we'll take them to Western Australia and rehouse them, they'll die because they can only survive on the regional eucalyptus they were brought up on.
But we have them in zoos.
Well, they have to bring the eucalyptus from wherever
from
they came
from. From the particular area.
They bring a plant and they keep growing it. You see what I mean? You know,
so that's poor evolution on their part, isn't it? They need to adapt better.
Well, they'll be wiped out. Most Australians, by the way, get quite irritated about the way the world loves koalas because they are just a pest. They sleep 20 hours a day.
They're like squirrels, really, aren't they?
Yeah, they are. They don't do anything. They're
useless
animals.
Have you ever hugged one?
No.
They piss all over you.
Oh, no, thank you. I don't want to get into that. So you know, what I'm really saying is that Australia's going to change quite dramatically after this, because although they have bushfires every year, you sometimes say to yourself, what mad people live there? I say that about Californians every summer, don't you?
I say that about people who live in Sicily underneath Mount Etna.
Yes.
Why would you stay there?
Yes, that's
when
right.
This bloody thing is going to explode every few years.
No, I totally agree. But the California thing, I've never understood it. People live in California.
On
they
the
know,
San Andreas fault line.
Yeah, that's right. And they know they've got a 1 in 4 chance every summer having their house burned down by a bushfire. And yet when you say, well, why don't you move to somewhere where there aren't fires? They say, but this is California. Everything else is great about California. And California does have an amazing allure, doesn't it? If you're driving up Sunset Boulevard, you know, at 6 a.m. in the morning after you've been out all night and that kind of stuff, palm trees and all that, it has an amazing allure, doesn't it?
It used to for me.
Yeah.
I think that sort of wore off about 15 years ago.
Pacific
it's not the same.
Palisades and all that. I love all that.
Los Angeles today is as it was when we used to work there all the time, but with a lot less money. It's
why?
Not as glamorous.
It all gone?
It's just not as glamorous as
really?
It once was. It's gone everywhere else is where it's gone.
Yeah, well, that could be the case. But the Australian thing, I really like Australians. I've worked with loads of them, particularly in America in the 80s and 90s. Mr. Murdoch had, you know.
So what about him? I mean, he's, you know, he's the guy, the Australian with all the money.
Well, he's not. He's an American. I mean, he's an American citizen.
Okay, but he's Australian
born. Yeah, of course he is. Of course he is. So I'm surprised.
So why aren't you harnessing his energy and his bank balance?
I totally agree. I mean, look.
We could take a ship out.
Yeah, or something like that. I mean, you're absolutely right. If I lived and worked in America, an Australian citizen, and I suddenly discovered that Chester had burnt down, my hometown, I'd get over there quick if I was a billionaire, and I'd say I'm going to, you know, be in charge of rebuilding it without a shadow of a doubt.
How many weeks do you sail down to Australia?
Oh, it'd take about 6 weeks.
Oh, that's too long.
Yeah,
we need a plane.
It could take 6 weeks. It took 6 days to get across the Atlantic in the QE2. Australia's about 10 times the distance, so 10, 6 is 60.
A long time.
It could be 6 weeks.
No. Yeah. We need a plane.
I mean, do you know that when, and your father might have even done this, when the cricket touring teams went to Australia for the Ashes, they went by boat. Freddie Truman would go by, and all the team would go by boat. They would literally spend 6 weeks on a boat where you can't really exercise properly if you're an athlete, you know what I mean?
Well, you walk around the deck, don't you?
Well, you would walk around the deck, but I mean, that's slightly boring, isn't it?
Kind of.
The England cricket team in training, you know, with a pair of pumps on, running around the deck of a coal steamer heading for Australia for the Ashes. Doesn't really fit, does it? Right, OK, folks, thank you very much indeed for listening to Life on Planet Porky. And Leslie Ann, great to have had you in the studio again today. And, folks, we will be back with you very soon. Where it all started was Christine Keeler used to like mixing in the African community in Notting Hill, OK? And she liked boyfriends who were big and muscular, of coloured origin.
There was
right?
a phrase, wasn't there, which is completely on PC, which we're not supposed to say, yeah. but we can. Once yeah. you've had black, you never look back.
Oh, well, maybe that's the case. I wouldn't know, because, of course,
me
I'm a different
neither.
Sex to you. So, but anyway, thank you very
I'm
much
I'm a
indeed.
Different sex to me, but,
yeah,
you know.
Thank you very much indeed, Leslie Ann,
You're
for,
welcome.
You know, availing us of that piece of, what can I say, biophysical information.
I'm not racist, by the way.
No, of course you're not. I know you're not. They had a very open marriage. His wife was a woman called Valerie Hobson, who was an actress.
She was an actress,
She
yeah.
was shagging around, you know, on the Hollywood scene at the same time as Profumo was banging away at, you know, any showgirl who'd get his hands on. He was a prolific shagger for Profumo. And the thing that's never really mentioned is that, you know, although Christine Keeler was the centre of this story, he had dozens of young showgirls that he was banging away in his office in Whitehall.
He'd had a terrible life with this dreadful person of a father who also was a curb crawler, who also had a penchant for rent boys, who was known...
Oh, yeah.
Well, both.
Well, you got into a car after drinking champagne all night.
Only a couple. Not all night. You do exaggerate. He does exaggerate.
He's probably had a driver anyway.